Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, this is your host with the most, Nikki Kalula. How are you? We're going to jump right into the interview. We got a very special guest. I've been trying to schedule this guest for months and months and months. Mr. Doug Messenger, say hello.
Hello.
Oh, our studio audience loves you. Worth the wait, Doug. Worth the wait. Silence.
Silence.
I can silence the audience just like that.
Okay.
Doug Messenger, you know what? It was a thrill to work with you years ago and be introduced to you, but it's only been more of an adventure getting to know you and being a deeper friend with you and making more music with you. It has been one of the most spectacular experiences of my life.
Thank you.
And I'm so incredibly honored that you are here tonight to be interviewed, to let us know about all the goods that you've been doing and all the bads that you've been doing too.
Sitting there running my studio.
That's right. So you've been working at hard drive, digital and analog recording.
Analog and digital.
Damn it. I knew. You know what? I said it and I knew I messed it up. Hard drive, analog, and digital recording.
Well, we've changed the name.
You used to just be Hard Drive Studios, right?
Yeah, and before that it was just Doug's. Doug's, then Doug
Whose
Messenger's.
Whose wacky idea was that?
Everyone who comes in there, everyone tells me what I should do.
Right.
But lately I'd heard a lot of hard drive sounds old.
No, I like hard drive.
The internet people all see it as old. So I changed the name again. Now we're Audio Grand.
No, why? Hard drive is so good.
Well, maybe you can talk me into it.
Yeah. You know what? You know why hard drive is good? Because you always need a hard drive. Huh?
I've got hard drive for her software.
So let's go way, way, way back because you've got so many amazing stories. You grew up. You were born in New York. I didn't know about this until today. You grew up briefly on Long Island.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you remember anything about Long Island?
Yes, I do. I remember everything.
Tell me about some of the memories you have.
I have memory. My earliest memory that's clear was sitting on a fence, a little stone fence in the backyard when I was about 3.5 or 4, and looking out, and there was new growing grass in the yard. My dad had, we had a huge yard. It went back about 200 feet. And there was a little apple tree in the middle. And I remember little robins bouncing around on the grass. And I remember the green grass and red tomatoes that my mother was growing on the other side.
Looking That's awesome.
At the little tree and the birds and looking up in the sky. It was bright blue sky with little white clouds. And I remember, to the left, there was a forest. We were right at the edge of a forest. Now it's all built up, but the house that we had is still there. And I just remember thinking, I like this. This is cool.
You're like, Long Island is a good place to be. And then your parents yanked you from that.
I just decided there, at that moment, I knew I liked life. I liked things that were going on. I just loved it.
That's amazing.
I haven't changed my mind. People have asked me, have you changed a lot? You know, most people go through all sorts of changes in their lives. They do drugs for a while. They don't do drugs. They're a socialist, and then they become capitalist, and then they go back to being socialist. I've never changed. I'm the same guy as I was at 3. I didn't know this until a few people whom I hadn't seen since I was in grade school came to visit me here. And they were sitting there, and they looked at one another, and they said, he's the same as he was in first and second grade.
Did you get that picture that I found of you on the internet?
Yeah, that was when I weighed 135 pounds.
That was, what year was that?
1967.
That is crazy. It's a cool picture.
Yeah, with
you're
the,
playing.
I'm
you're
playing that old Telecaster.
Yeah, you playing it's an
actually,
Esquire.
It's a Nocaster. No, it's an Ocaster.
Oh, okay, okay.
It's earlier, and it's a. It was the best guitar I ever owned.
So let me ask you this. Beautiful. You know, I know you moved to Mexico right after that. You were about 4 years old. Mm-hmm. You spent the next 13 years living in Mexico. Did you pick up guitar then?
No, I didn't. I loved rock music as a little kid.
What were you listening to as a kid?
A little kid, I was listening to Fats Waller and Count Basie and classical, like Grieg and Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky, my parents listened to.
Yeah.
And at three, I was able to go, my dad would say, go pick out a record, and he'd say, find the March Slav. And I knew where they all were, even though I couldn't read yet. But I had memorized the way the records looked.
Oh, that's
crazy.
And so
I'd come out with them, and of course, my dad would pat me on the back and look at his guests, and he'd go, see? I said, wait till they find out what happens when I end up in San Quentin.
So did you sing or anything?
Nothing.
Nothing.
In school, we all sang.
Yeah, you did the chorus or something
like that.
But I
never, I took piano lessons for a few minutes, and it didn't.
How old were you?
Maybe seven.
Wow.
And it didn't work.
Start with classical?
Second one. The first teacher, you know, I wanted to learn the boogie because I had heard Pete Johnson and, what's his name? Albert Ammons and the other one. There were three guys. They were the main boogie players. And the teacher didn't know the boogie. So I quit.
You don't know the boogie, I quit.
Yeah, that's right. Little Dougie being a wise ass.
Little Dougie wanted the boogie.
And then they got me a Russian piano teacher. Her name was Skorina.
Hmm.
And Skorina was a classical person, taught me Ferlis and some little Haydn.
Oh, the classics, yeah.
Some Haydn things. And I did it for a little while, but I never was enthusiastic about the piano. So anyway, when 1954 came along and we started to hear more blues, and I had heard some blues by Jimmy Reed and some of those people, because my dad was an avid record collector and he liked black music. And I remember really, I heard Jimmy Reed do take out some insurance on me, baby. And I said, that is amazing. Then I heard Rocket 88. Which was basically Good Golly Miss Molly with different words 4 years or 5 years before Good Golly Miss Molly by Jackie Brenston, I think. And then when Elvis hit, that was it. That was it, but I didn't play anything yet.
But you wanted to shake your hips like that, I'm sure.
Oh, I did. I was the best dancer in my high school.
That's crazy.
You know, in fact, I was voted best dancer. Best leader and best dancer.
So you just sang chorus in high school.
Yeah.
You were learning Elvis's dance moves.
Yeah.
And when did you pick up the guitar?
Not till I was in college.
Wow.
I went off to Princeton, you know, to be an engineer because that Sputnik had gone up in the sky and they needed engineers. And my dad said, you're going to engineering school. I said, I don't know. I don't give a damn about math. He says, yeah, but you got straight A's in math, so you're going to go. I never liked math. To me, it's boring as hell. Once you understand a concept, you solve a few problems that are tricky, you like it. But it didn't wake me up.
Hmm.
So I went to Princeton, went through with it. Then I worked for Bethlehem Steel afterward for a couple of years.
You went back to New York.
Yeah, went back to New York. I was my wife, Jeannie. Still the love of my life.
Yeah, that's right.
And who left us in 1969. She had one of the first kidney transplants ever given.
That's crazy.
And she was fine with that, but she got pneumonia because it's a thing that still plagues the hospitals today. Some bacteria that people who are weak can't fight. So I was at Princeton. There was a guy who lives downstairs from me. I'll even give his name, Bob Sterla.
Bob Sterla. How do you remember this? Your memory is so sharp.
I don't know. Bob Sterla had a Martin guitar. And I was sitting there looking at it one day. He says, go ahead, try it. And I played it. I didn't play it. I just grabbed it and started poking around it. And he came over and showed me an E chord.
And that opened
all the doors. And I went nuts with it. And when I went back home for the summer in 1961.
That's when you met your wife.
Same year that I met her. we threw a party at our house, and one of the local rock bands in Mexico City was there, you know, at our house. And they left their instruments when they left at night, and we're going to pick them up the next day. Well, I was up at 6 in the morning taking a Fender Jazzmaster and a Les Paul Custom out of the cases and plugging them into the amps and trying it. And I by then I could play a few chords.
Right.
And in college, that same year, Chuck Berry played there, first time I met him. And he showed me how to play a ninth chord.
That is crazy.
I was there with, I still remember the girl, Judy Cranston. She was flaming red hair.
Wait, so Chuck Berry played at Princeton?
Yeah. Played at one of, they have the equivalent of fraternities. They're called eating clubs because you don't live there. They don't like that. They just have the president of the eating club lives there with the vice president. And all the rest of us were just in dormitories, you know, on the campus.
What'd you say to Chuck Berry?
I don't remember, but I remember Judy touched him, my girlfriend at the time, she touched him, and she was thrilled to death that she had touched Chuck Berry. I said, I'm glad she's not in a room alone with him. And
he taught you how to play a ninth chord, like a funk chord.
He put his hand, he said, watch this. I told him I play guitar. I didn't really, but I told him so. And he said, I'll teach you a chord. I said, what is it? And he went, you know, this, you know the one, the main.
Yeah, yeah, the main James Brown chord. Yeah.
James Brown chord later. And he showed me that chord. And then I started getting more serious about it. And that was before I went home and played around with another band's equipment without their knowing it. And I started a band. I just started talking to guys around during the summer, and we threw together a summertime band. We were called the Five, Los Cinco in Spanish, but there were just four of us.
Were you singing in English? Were you
playing? Yes, English.
Wow.
Did What I Say by Ray Charles, Oopoopadoo by
nice.
Jesse Hill, High Blood Pressure by Huey Smith and the Clowns, the stuff that I liked. And it was fun. And yeah, it's quite a story. To see, I mean, each musician has stories like this, but...
You know what? I'll tell you the truth. Not all musicians do have stories like this. That's what is very genuine.
Well, they've done too many drugs and they don't remember who they are.
Well, that's true, too. But you know what? What's amazing is, so you meet Chuck Berry, and that's not enough of a moment where you're like, I need to be a musician.
No.
It's the beginning, though.
It's the at the beginning.
And then you went back to New York.
I was home...
You were in Mexico, right?
I was in Mexico. We're backing up now to when I was in college. After college, I went to New York and worked for Bethlehem Steel. Didn't like it at all. It was a corporate job, and I did really well there. They were talking about making me vice president within 3 years.
Wow.
And I said, 3 years? I want to be, why not now? I just saved your butts with the foreign orders. And they were having trouble getting the steel to the ships in Sparrows Point, Maryland. I found out why they were having trouble getting the orders for Pakistan and India and Europe and stuff, why they weren't going out. And it had to do with the credit ratings of the American companies and trying to protect the American companies in some weird way that I never understood.
Some tax thing, I'm sure.
And so but when I explained to them what they could do, and I got a huge order shipped to Pakistan in a week after I looked into it, they were amazed.
Hmm.
And that's when they started talking nicely to me.
And you're like, I quit.
I quit.
And you decided, did you decide then and there you wanted to do music? I never decided it.
I just did it.
That's how I am.
I don't plan things.
But you auditioned for Berklee College of Music.
Yeah, I went to Berklee.
But you moved to Boston. What was the thing that made you move to Boston?
Berklee.
So you auditioned for them first?
I used to buy Downbeat magazine.
Right.
And there was a chord progression course in there once. And it was amazing. I still have it in my head. And nobody teaches chord progression the way they did at Berklee in 1964. I went there in 64. And I started playing in a local band in 65 with Bobby Duke and the Counts. He was a very, very good singer, black guy. Nice guy, and the bands in Boston were all integrated. There was no racial animus at all. Everyone got along.
That's awesome.
In Boston. Now, I heard that when you got, if you lived in the Roxbury or you lived in Dorchester, there was animosity and racism there. But in the music business, there was none.
That's amazing.
It was wonderful. It
says a lot about musicians there.
And so I got to back Chuck Berry once in Boston.
And did you remind him about that ninth chord that he taught you?
No, I did. I told him I met you when I was in college. He didn't remember it. And then I got to back him again in 1971 in Hawaii. Bill Medley from the Righteous Brothers had put together an all-star band. I had a lot of auditions, and I made it into the band for a singer named Chris Morgan. He was a gay man, one of the most amazing voices imaginable, 6th octave range.
Wow.
Crazy range, and he could do anything. He's a nice guy, but obsessed, an obsessed person. And Bill Medley sent us to Alaska for 5 months and Hawaii for 6 months. He says, you guys make it a real band by playing a lot, and when you get back, we'll make a record. Well, that never happened because Chris Morgan was a troublemaker. In Alaska, we got thrown out after 4 months because Chris Morgan was trying to start a race riot.
Wow.
He's a white guy trying to stir it up.
Yeah, stir up the pot. And,
you know, there was an army base up in Fairbanks, Alaska, or near. And when we got there, it was a nice integrated club the way it was everywhere, you know. This is way later in 71. We didn't talk at all about those groups in Boston, but it's...
We'll come back to it, don't worry.
I don't know, you run this...
You said you were backing up Chuck Berry in Hawaii.
In Hawaii, well, we were in Hawaii, we were playing at the Merry Monarch, and I heard that Chuck Berry was going to be at the HIC Auditorium. And I told the band, I'm not coming in tonight. And they said, what do you mean that you're not going to come in tonight? I'm going to the HIC to see if I can be in Chuck's band. He said, he has a band. No, he never had a band. He would just hire local guys.
Yeah, local guys.
So I went there, and by the time I got there, I took my amp, took my guitar, and it was that Nocaster and my Gibson GA46. And when I got there, you know, I set it down. You know, there were some other guys, and he's starting to go through the guitar players. And he looked at me, he said, did you back me in Boston once? He didn't remember the incident in college where he taught me a chord.
Right.
But I said, yeah, I backed you in Boston. I think it was might have been Basin Street East or Connolly's, one of those places. Chuck Berry would do any gig they came up with if there was good money.
Right.
And so he looked at me, and he just looked at the other guys. He says, I've got the guitar. You guys can go home. Now, where he got lucky was that this little Hawaiian kid was a drummer from heaven. The guy was incredible. He was probably 18 or 19 max. I was in my late 20s because when my wife died, I was 28 or 27. This is this is a little after. It's 1971. And this kid knew the Chuck Berry songbook. And he had the feel like Earl Palmer, the guy who played on
the
records by Little Richard. Sometimes Chuck Berry's drummer wasn't Earl Palmer, but the kid had that style. But he could fit with Chuck. And we got a keyboard guy and a bass player, and we went on stage. And it was an amazing night. Lee Michaels was the headliner. He had a song called Do You Know What I Mean? He was an organ player, and he had a drummer, a kid named Frosty. And Frosty and Lee did their thing. But they weren't going to get to do their thing that night because Chuck Berry did something amazing. We went out there, and as usual, Chuck's a real, let's face it, he was a real asshole.
Right.
You know,
right.
He's trying to make us look bad, looking at the audience like, well, these guys are messing up. And he would do that by playing a song and all of a sudden hitting a downbeat, a beat early.
Right.
And the band gets thrown for a minute, and then you're back into it. Or he'd do a beat, half a beat late. And he did that stuff. But when he noticed, I had talked to the guys before we went on, he's going to pull this stuff. So watch me, and I will, when you see me go, you're going to be in there. Mm. And don't come in again till after that. And when I see that he's about to do it, I watch his foot. He'd say, Alpha, I lift my leg and stomp down, you stop playing. Lift my leg again, stomp down, we start again. So anyway, he did it twice, and we were right there with him. And that changed his attitude. All of a sudden, his guitar was in tune.
Hmm.
He was singing in tune. And he was singing the way he did on the records. A higher pitch voice. He wasn't improvising the melodies nearly as much. You know, usually live, he's all over the place.
Right, right.
And he wasn't. And the audience went nuts because he was doing the duck walk and all the other things. And at the end of the show, there was an encore to be played. And Chuck said, when we were at backstage, he said, "I do one encore based on the money you've already paid me." Chuck always got paid in advance, cash. And he said, "If there's another encore, though, you're going to pay me more. So you may as well go to the bank now, because the way that audience is reacting, they're going to want more than just one song." And the promoter guy was, "No, come on, Chuck." Then he says, no. "Get lost while we play this." So we played a song, and then we went off stage and waited a little bit, and the audience is still out there yelling, "Chuck, Chuck, Chuck." And I've never seen anything like it. And I'm, "Chuck, Chuck, Chuck." So so Chuck gets the extra money from the promoter who had come back from the bank, and Chuck said to him, "I hope you brought more than that, because it's going to be more than one more encore." And it ended up being three more encores.
Wow.
And when we went off, Lee Michaels set up to play, and they booed him off the stage, and we had to go out again.
Wow.
And then Chuck said, I want so much. I don't know what the amount was. And when we were through with it, like, it was amazing. I've looked online, and they show concerts at the HIC, but not that one.
That's
I don't
weird.
Know why.
Well, maybe they didn't have it recorded that night.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, they didn't record anything in those days.
Mm.
71, it was rare. Maybe in California, but not there. So anyway, that was the Chuck Berry night. And then Chris Morgan, the guy I was in the band with, he got us thrown out of Hawaii, too.
Well, let's go back to Boston now. Now, we're in Boston, 67. You dropped out of Berklee because your wife got sick.
Yes.
And you started playing in all these R&B bands.
Yes.
And you started backing up some of the baddest of the bad. Just list them off. Al Green's one. I'll start.
Well, that was a gig that was done away from Boston. I went on the road with a band, and we went to Bowling Green, Missouri, and then Grand Rapids, Michigan. And we got to Grand Rapids, and the club we were supposed to play at had gone under.
Wow.
And our agent wasn't notified, Fred Petty. And we what are we going to do? We're sitting there starving to death one night, and we're one of those little coffee shops that were everywhere in America then, the low stools in front of a curvy bar. And in walked a tall, good-looking black guy named Palmer James. Mm. He goes, looks at us, sees our instruments because we took them in with us. "Can you boys play? I'm Palmer James." And he turned around, and his scruffy little guy behind him says, "This is Al Green. He's going to be a star."
Wow.
And
so you played with him before anyone knew?
Nobody ever heard of him.
Wow,
and
dude.
He recorded a song. Well,
I got chills.
So what happened is we went to this club the next day, and he said, "You guys better be able to play." I said, "Look, we've been playing James Brown and Otis Redding, you know, and Marvin Gaye and, you know, Calvin Arnold." I named all the things that people don't even remember because I was a big R&B freak.
Right.
I was also a Beatle freak. I was a Beatle freak.
Who wasn't?
They just blew my mind. And then later, Cream and Led Zeppelin were the next big thing for me. But anyway, what was I saying?
You're talking about Al Green.
Al Green. So we went to this club, and there was a group called the People's Choice, and there were five, I think it was five singers, three girls and two men or something like that. I don't remember the exact composition. And they would come out on stage and sing. And then Al would come out and do, right after they did their thing, Al came out. And I noticed this guy, he didn't look so hot in those days. You know, he was a little, he didn't look like he needed a cleaner shirt and stuff like that. But when he went on and started to sing, girls would take their blouses off.
Wow.
And run toward the stage to hug him.
Did you take your blouse off, Doug?
No, I dropped my pants for one of the girls. In any event, so Al was amazing, but my wife was sick back in Boston, and I had to leave. So I went back to Boston, and the band remained there with Alf until about April of '66.
Wow.
This was like No, that was early 66. I met Hendrix in 65.
We're
going
to get to that story, too. Yeah, we're going to get to that story.
The Al Green thing took place early 66, and I went back to Boston, and the other guys stayed there till the summer playing with Al. And I think they recorded a song called Backup Train.
Hmm.
It is online somewhere. I wasn't there for that. But I got to meet Al. He was nice guy.
And he was killing, I'm sure.
And he had that voice that just turns women on.
Yeah. You know, he still has it, man. I just saw him recently, and it was mind-blowing how good he was.
Yeah, he is very good.
So tell me about opening. I mean, you backed up Etta James. How did that come about?
Well, that was in Boston. And in Boston, and back, this was probably the case all over America back in the late 60s. R&B acts rarely went on a tour with the whole Motown band or something. It was usually the singer, a bass player, or the singer and a keyboard player with some charts.
Right.
You go to a club and do what Chuck Berry did. You pick a band the day before you're going to play or the day you're going to start. And I can't remember if this was at Basin Street East. That's what it feels like, I'm trying to picture the place. But anyway, the three people who were going to put on a show were a guy named D. Clark. D. Clark had three major hits in the early 60s, and he was struggling to find another hit. He's a guy with a voice, I'm not kidding, better than Jackie Wilson's voice.
Wow.
This guy, everybody go listen to D. Clark, Raindrops, or Nobody But You, or Hey Little Girl in the High School Sweater, or Let's Keep It Up. Amazing singer.
Wow.
And the three people on the bill were going to be D. Clark, who's the best singer of the three, Lots of Papa, who is a 400-pound guy, real name is Julius High, and he's a great guy. One of those guys you feel, he'd see you, he'd hug you, and you'd say, geez, he's going to kill me. 400 pounds.
That's crazy.
And he was a blues, he was doing a blues thing, but he's really more of an R&B singer.
Right, like a soul thing.
But he wanted to do the blues thing. And maybe it's because Etta James was the headliner, and she had that hit song, Tell Mama.
Yeah.
And so we backed Etta, and she picked me. In fact, she's the one who picked us, the band that came in. Maybe seven guitar players, three drummers, and they'd have you play a little.
Was she all together, or was she like drunk?
No, she drank, and I think she was doing heroin as well. But she was on the ball on stage, and she was nice to us. And she came in, and she said, "Who knows my songs?" I knew who was going to be on the bill. So the night before, I was up all night learning D. Clark songs and Etta James songs.
Wow.
Lots of
Papa. Doing your homework. That's the best.
I've never heard of Lots of Papa. But he was such a great guy. He died recently.
Wow.
Not 2006 or something.
Wow.
He was in Georgia. I read about him recently. And you can hear him. There are a couple of things on YouTube of his. And so anyway, Etta said, "You can play my songs? What do you know?" And I said, "Well, Tell Mama, At Last, you know."
You played At Last with Etta James?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Also got to
chills again.
Also got to play I'd Rather Go Blind.
Yeah, I love that song.
Yeah, and I don't remember the others. But
what about Sunday Kind of Love? Did you ever play Sunday Kind of Love?
I probably did that.
That was one of my favorite songs.
She had charts. But I knew her stuff, and that amazed her.
She said, you know those songs? Oh, yeah.
She just said to the other guys, "Go home. He's my guitar player."
Wow.
Because I did some homework. There was a guy there named Johnny Trope who was better than I was. George Walker, the black kid. Amazing guitar player. Cool guy. He taught me something I still know on guitar, George Walker. I'll show it to you the next time we're together. It's an amazing chord progression to end a song
with. Were you kind of like one of those, like when you were in that moment playing with Etta James, was it kind of like an oh shit moment? Like, oh my God.
No. I was never nervous about anything when it came to being on stage. I don't know why.
I just felt like, okay, I just come up here.
I'm going to play the way I play. If you like it, good.
Wow.
You know, if you don't, well, you don't.
So you played with so many great bands in Boston just because you were in the scene, you were in the mix.
Yeah, I was with Roger Pace, who was the guy in New England at the time. He's a redheaded guy who later dyed his hair black because he loved James Brown so much. He was a white guy who could dance not quite as well as James, but almost.
Right.
And but he could play sax or drums as well as anybody. He used to go to the jazz workshop in Boston and sit in with Ornette Coleman or sit in with John Coltrane on alto. He was an alto player.
That's crazy.
He died a few years back, and he was a great performer. I like telling stories about Roger Pace. I won't go into the crazy stuff. And he was also a meth addict.
Wow,
he'd take crystal meth and put it in a bottle, a glass of Coca-Cola, and drink it.
Wow.
And he liked pills, too.
Oh, the 70s.
All these pills. This is the 60s.
60s, late 60s.
Late That's 60s. Right. I was with him in 67 and again in 68. He had the best bass player and guitar player I ever heard in my life in 64 and 5. A guy, brothers, Bobby Simone and Dickie Simone. Bobby Simone, everybody, the greatest guitar player who ever lived.
Wow.
He was R&B, but beyond R&B. And he had chops to play solos that would blow your mind.
How big was the band?
Roger Pace's band varied from 3 and him to 7 or 8 and him.
Wow.
Like, you'd go over to Berkeley sometimes and get a bunch of horn players. And I started building up a pile of charts that I wrote.
Who were some of the most famous musicians you went to school with? Do you remember?
John Abercrombie, who's a famous guitar player. Johnny Trope, a top session guitar player. Ernie Watts.
Yeah.
Tenor player and alto player.
My favorites,
actually. He started with Buddy Rich. That's how he got famous. And let me think. I don't remember.
Well, I mean, you listed a bunch. That's all right.
Yeah. So anyway, I played with Roger Pace off for about 3 months, 67 and 3 months, 68. And he would get nuts and he'd rip the band off and get the club owners to hate him and they'd fire us, you know.
And
but then they'd beg him to come back because he could do this. One night we were up at a place somewhere in Massachusetts and there's a blizzard going on. A blizzard and empty club. Nobody in there, just the bartender and the owner and a few things. And Roger said, "We're not going off the stage till this place is packed." I said, "Roger, no one's going to come." And we played from 7:20 at night till 2 in the morning.
Wow.
By 11 at night, the place was packed because the few people who came in just to grab a drink saw this guy putting on a show as if it were the James Brown show.
Wow.
And a white kid, you know, who's like...
So it became a spectacle almost.
It was. He was... Yeah. He's the kind of guy who, if there was another bar across the street, he'd get the horn section and go over there with them and bring back half of that club.
Wow.
And the mob wanted to kill him over things like that. But in Boston, the Bolero brothers, who owned the Intermission Lounge, liked Roger, and they told all the other bars, all the other mafia guys who were in New England at the time, "You stay away from Roger Pace, he's ours."
Wow.
And so we got treated with respect everywhere, even when Roger would do insane shit like that. It was really something.
So tell me about, let's get to the, I know you have a very amazing story that I love hearing. This is the time that you met Jimi Hendrix. This is the first time you met Jimi Hendrix.
Okay, 1965. My first professional band had been in mid-65. I had quit Bethlehem Steel. I had started at Berkeley, and I got a job with a guy named Bobby Duke, you know, and I quit him, and I got with a band called Bobby Ace and the Stacked Deck, and it was another little R&B band with a singer who was a great guy, but he wasn't, you know, the right guy for any band.
Right.
But he a nice guy, and we were playing in Revere Beach, and we got done early one night because it was empty, and they said, "Go home, guys." Well, this is a band that had played to a lot of empty clubs. And I said, "Let's go up to the Tiger's Tail. This Joey D and the Starlighters, who had done Peppermint Twist, are going to be there." And this is 4 years after their big hit in 61 with the Twist. And so we went in. And we walked in, and there they were. The backup singers turned out to be the guys who later were the Young Rascals.
Oh, wow.
Eddie Brigati and Felix Pappalardi. And I noticed right away, those guys are great backgrounds, backup singers. Well, they're both lead singers. But they were young guys. Nobody knew them then. And Joey D came out and sang his songs. And I looked over at the guitar player, and there was a lefty, a black kid, lefty, short hair, wearing a do-rag, really sharply dressed. I mean, perfectly tailored pants with a nice crease, patent leather shoes with the short pants like the Motown guys, so you could see the nylon stocking socks that you could see through, and I was watching him, and all of a sudden he put the guitar up to his mouth, and then he put it behind his back and between his legs, and then he took it up, and, you know, he played with his teeth.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's
behind his head too, of course.
Played behind his head.
Old Lightning Hopkins.
Did all the things he did later, except he didn't hump his amplifiers.
Right.
That's something I'll tell you later. He regretted it later.
Hmm.
He felt that it was really in bad taste. I said, no kidding, Jimmy. You know. But anyway, so he told me his name was Jimmy James. Okay, they finished their set. It was the end of the night. We got there for the last set. And the mob guys walked over. Hey, flat faces, go down in the basement. There's go down there and take your jackets off and shit. And we got to clean up here. So we all went downstairs, and I'm talking to Joey D for a minute and all that. And all of a sudden, Jimmy James, who's really Jimi Hendrix, unknown to us, looks at on the floor, and there was a Monopoly game, and there was also a little bridge table there. You know. Four-legged bridge table. And he says, anyone for Monopoly? And my bass player, Richie Mayer, drummer, Bobby Glaze, and I all said, we'll do it, because we liked him. You know, he had been really nice, friendlier than the rest of the guys. He was, Hendrix is a very low-key, soft-spoken guy. Spoke kind of quietly.
Right.
You know, he says, Monopoly, anyone? Bam, sit down. First goddamn throw of the dice, and, you know, or second, he ended up on Boardwalk right away. I said, you lucky son.
I remember you telling me that story. You're like, motherfucker, Boardwalk in the first roll.
We were having fun, though. It was really a nice night, and he was straight, and he looked sharp, man. And so anyway, we did that, and the mob guys came down again. Hey, flat faces, get out of here. You know? Get out of here. You know, so we left, and that was it. And I'm go ahead 5 years. This is probably somewhere, that was November or December of 65. Move 5 years ahead to 1970. Doug is in L.A., and I went to the Whiskey one day to see my friend Danny Weiss, who is the guy from whom Joe Walsh got his whole style. And Joe will tell you that. He said, Danny Weiss, the greatest guitar player on the West Coast.
Wow.
Weiss never made it. He was with Alice Cooper for a minute. He was with Bette Midler. He was in a lot of different things, but never what he really did best. And I was in a group called Rhinoceros as well. They had one little hit in instrumental called Apricot Brandy.
Mm.
Boom, boom, bam, boom, boom, bam, boom, 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 that kind of thing. And I'd gotten to know Danny because I really loved his playing. I'd heard him on that Rhinoceros record. And I went to meet him at the Whiskey, and he said, my two little Marshalls blew up on me. There was a Marshall that they only made 50 of that's the most amazing amp I ever heard. And he said, every 6 months or so, I've got to take them in and get them repaired. And he said... And I said, well, I've got an amp in my car. And I said, so if you're going to do the sound check, this is like noon or one in the afternoon. So I got my Gibson amp out and left it with him. Took one of the Marshalls down to
the repair shop,
a guy named Van who had a place called, I think it was called Modern Music. And it was on Cole Street next to the Cinerama Dome. And he said, hang around, I'll see if I can fix these. He says, oh, I've seen one of these before. I have a picture of one now, by the way. First picture I've ever been able to find. It was a bigger box than a Blues Breaker and a way better sounding amp. It sounded like Eddie Van Halen's Marshall, but maybe even better because it was an open back cabinet. It would sing, man. That amp was incredible. So I went back and I ran in, Danny ran out, and, you know, he took the Marshall, and I said, I'll take the other one now, right? And I took the other one out, put it in my, I went around the back at the Whiskey, put it in my car, and then I forgot something to tell Danny about how much the guy wanted. So I ran back into the Whiskey, and when I came out, across the street, Music Hall, was a little music store where there's Oz now.
Yep.
And
I know right what you're talking about.
There's Jimi Hendrix standing there on the corner talking to a crowd around him. And I go, that's Jimi Hendrix, man. I want to meet him. So I walked across the street, and I'm
not knowing that you had already met him 5 years prior.
I didn't know that. I didn't know him as Jimi Hendrix.
Right, you knew
he looked so different, the crazy hair.
Right.
And that day, he looked pretty bad. You know, he looked greasy, and his clothes were dirty, and there were stains on his satin pants and stuff like that. Or maybe they were, I don't know if they were satin, something like that. But it was really good clothes that he hadn't taken care of. It looked like he had slept in it. And he's standing there, and he looked kind of, he's messed up a little. He was slurring his words a little. And all of a sudden, he looked out at me, and he goes, I know you. And I said, I don't know you. I know you're Jimi Hendrix, and I think Axis Bold as Love is one of the best records I've ever owned. It is, to this day.
I agree.
It is phenomenal.
Yep.
You know, and he said, I said, I don't know you, man. And he said, where are you from? I said, I'm from New York. Where else are you from? Mexico. He goes, no. And we talked a little bit, and all of a sudden he said, how about some other places on the East Coast? I said, why East Coast? He says, well, I played with some people back there. I said, who? Like Joey D and the Starlighters. And then he looked at me, and he said, were you in Boston? I said, yeah. And he said, Monopoly. He remembered better than I did, and he's the drug addict.
And you must have been like, Boardwalk.
Yeah. Boardwalk, son of a bitch. Yeah, Boardwalk. And so we talked for a while, and we walked down past Book Soup, which used to be up there.
Yeah.
And we walked all the way down to where Tower Records is on the other side, though, and then walked back. And on the way back, he was talking about how he really had to stop doing drugs. He said, it's really messing with me. He said, I've had a lot of problems, you know, because of it, and I'm not on the ball, and I'm unreliable, and some things like that, and I've got to get it together. And so I ran into the liquor store that's still there on that halfway down that block, the block up by the whiskey, and I went in and got a little, I said, give me a piece of paper and a pen. And the guy said, I don't have paper, but here's a matchbook. You know, every place had matchbook. So I wrote my phone number in it, went back out there, and he had already walked up to the corner. He kept walking when I walked away from him. And I said, Jimmy, here's, by then, of course, I knew that he knew me.
Damn it, this guy's hitting on me, man.
Yeah. And I told him, call me and we'll talk about drugs. And I've helped several people in bands that I've been in to not do it. And he says, I don't know, man. I said, you can do it. You've told me what's wrong, you know, what's wrong in your life and some very personal things, you know, that I'm not going to say here.
Right, right.
Nothing criminal, though. It's just bad shit with chicks. And so I never heard from him, which proves if Doug Messenger says, call me and you don't, you
you
die.
You better call him.
You die.
And he died 3 or 4 months later.
I think he died in September, and that was May.
Wow.
I do remember because of Danny Weiss and him and all that.
What a trip that you met him twice, and you met him before he was Hendrix, and you met him
and
after.
I didn't recognize.
Yeah, that's wild. Well, because there's a transformation. It's like the chrysalis.
Yeah, when I saw Hendrix,
know?
I knew it was Hendrix.
Yeah.
But I didn't know it was the guy from Joey D and the Starlight.
What was the reason you moved from Boston to L.A.?
My wife, Jeannie, died. And her parents were Navy people, and they were living in San Diego at the time, and they said, come on out here. They had come to visit me and Jeannie in New York and then in Boston. Her mother visited us in New York. She just died last year, her mother. And
wow.
And her father came to see us in Boston. Jeannie was one of the early kidney transplant patients, and it didn't cost us because the doctors who did it hadn't had a pretty girl who needed a transplant. And they said, look, if you'll consent to being in some magazines with us, because we're talking about this new procedure, about a transplant and so forth, if Jeannie will, and Jeannie says, I'll do it. And so there are pictures somewhere in medical journals of Jeannie.
Wow.
She's a very pretty girl, smart as hell, IQ beyond Einstein. I'm not kidding.
Wow.
When I was in college, she came to see me for the senior prom, and I remember having a differential equations book that I was working on. And she said, this is interesting. You know, and I fell asleep. And the next morning I started, there she is with this calculus book again. And the whole, and she ended up, here's something I've never said to publicly. Jeannie came to the senior prom and she never left Princeton. We hid her in various rooms for the next 2 months. She came in April 9th, 1963. School got out in June 1st or so. So for a few months, April and May, we hid a girl in a dorm at Princeton.
That's hilarious.
And all the guys in the dorm were in on it. One of them was Tom Stossel, who's a famous doctor who just died recently, whose brother is a conservative guy on TV, John Stossel. You've probably seen him.
So her parents brought you to San Diego.
Brought me to San Diego.
And you fell in love with Los Angeles then?
I didn't fall in love with it, but I got a call from someone in Boston who said, you know, there's a guy named Tony Scotti. He's a producer. He's a movie star. He'd been in Valley of the Dolls. And he says, but he's a record producer. And I was talking to him, and he said, we're putting a band together called the California Earthquake. And it's going to be like Blood, Sweat, and Tears or Chicago, but the L.A. version. And that's what they were trying to do.
Right.
And they need a guitar player and someone who can help write out some of the charts and stuff. And people here in Boston told, Tony Scotti told people in Boston what he needed. And they told him, well, we know a guy named Doug Messenger who's in California somewhere. Somehow they found me, you know, and Tony Scotti called me and I went up to L.A. on a Greyhound bus. He picked me up on Riverside Drive at the Greyhound station, drove me up
There's
to
a song in there.
One block from where my studio today is.
That
the
is crazy.
First place I ever was in L.A. And he took me straight. He went by the club, which is a comedy club now. It's still there. It was called The Little Hobbit. And we drove by it, and he drove to Little Tony's restaurant, famous pizza place.
Yeah.
And we went in there. Little Tony's had, he said he'd get a bite to eat and all that. And he's a nice guy. He's married to Sylvie Vartan, who's a famous French singer and actress. Today, he's still alive, Tony. And he's one of those ridiculously handsome guys, you know. And he'd been in movies and stuff. And he's a record producer. So anyway, we went over to the club. I played for the band. Went to a bunch of rehearsals with them. And did a couple of recordings at TGG Studios, which used to be at right kitty corner to Hollywood High School. There's a big tall building there today. It's a museum now, but it was a studio where they had recorded the soundtracks for the Rocky movies and the early Rocky movies.
Well, a lot of people also don't know that you were the guitarist for Van Morrison right around 71,
right,
70.
Back in those days, if you're in a band, nobody talked about you. Yeah, you're just Van is the whole show.
So you said, I think you told me on the phone earlier that, you know, some of the guys that were in his band had been playing with you in Boston.
Yes, they had been playing. You know, after I did that thing for Tony Scotti, I'd gotten a band out here with a guy from Buffalo. Who I don't remember how I got in that band, but I was in a number of little bands, you know, from 69, 70, and I got a call from another guy, and it was Van Morrison. I remember now. I had worked at General Motors for a couple of months because I needed money, and playing little bar bands paid very little then. During the time I was in those little bar bands, I got to be in a room with Charles Manson.
Wow!
Right before they got arrested.
Wow!
I was playing. It was in '69. Late in the year, probably, I think it was right after the murders, somewhere in there. I don't remember the dates. And a girl came up to the bandstand for this little group. I was in a group called Goose. And the group had been called Smack, which was a phrase for heroin, Smack. But what the band meant was surfers, Mexicans, and colored kids. That was the band, Smack. And it was that band, but we had changed our name to Goose. I don't know why. And so in any case, girl comes up to the bandstand and says, can you play a Lee Michaels song? This is the guy who was with Chuck Berry the next year in Hawaii. And he said, no, we don't know any of his songs. And the girl turned and pointed at a little scruffy guy. That's Father. He wants a song by Lee Michaels.
Wow, it was Charles Manson?
We didn't know it was Charles Manson, but it was Charles Manson. We found this out a few weeks later when they were arrested. Jay Pelson, our keyboard player, came running down the driveway at our house in Sherman Oaks, two blocks from where I'm sitting right now. And he's saying, they're going to kill me. They're going to find me. They're going to kill me. Because what had happened was when they kept insisting on the song by that guy, Jay said, we'll play you some stuff by Joe Cocker, or we'll play you some stuff by this. And then the girl said, Father wants the Lee Michaels song. And Jay said, tell Father to go fuck himself. Tell Father to, right over the PA.
Wow.
Tell Father to go fuck himself. So when Jay ran in saying, they're going to kill me, I said, who's going to kill you? Remember the guy, the little scruffy guy?
And you realize it was Charles Manson.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
They arrested him. I don't know. He didn't know his name yet then. They arrested him. It's in the newspaper. Look, here's a picture. He had some pictures and stuff, you know.
Well, then how did you meet Van out of all of that?
Well, back in Boston, someone found me out who knew I was out here, talked to Tony Scotti. And Tony Scotti said, find me a guy. And someone in Boston who'd been in a band with me or had seen me play in other bands, who was playing with Van Morrison, mentioned my name, you know, and so let me think how that went. No, I remember now. I had been working at General Motors because I was broke after the Manson episodes and things like it. I went to work at General Motors building Camaros, Corvettes, you know, Firebirds, stuff like that. I really liked the job, but I got mononucleosis. I was sick as hell in Sherman Oaks, three blocks from here, right? And I was lucky I had a couple of friends who took care of me because I couldn't work, I couldn't do anything, and they were helping feed me and stuff. And one day I get a phone call. I say, who's this? It's Van Morrison. I said, Van Morrison, the guy who did, I knew some of his songs back then, one called Come Running to Me.
Yep.
And that's a good song.
And the Mystic.
And Caravan.
Yep.
And he hadn't put out, I think, he hadn't put out the one with Domino. That was coming later that year. This was in late 70. And so I went down to the Troubadour to meet Van. They played here. And I met him, you know, for a minute. But I really talked more to Rick Schlosser and Jack Schroer, the guys I knew from Boston who were in his band.
Right.
So they all had said, yeah, Doug's cool, man. Let's get Doug. So that's how it happened. But they went away. I didn't play with them or anything yet. And I got a call from Van, the call I just mentioned. I was sick from later in that year in 70. That was probably in the middle of 70. But in the end of the year, I was sick. And they called me. Van called me. And I said, well, I have mononucleosis. And he says, go to your doctor and find out when you can come back here. We'll get you out here. And so I got calls from Mary Martin, who was his manager at the time.
Right.
She later managed Emmylou Harris.
Yep. She's a badass.
And Emmylou Harris and Brian Ahern owned the studio that's three blocks up from the studio I have now.
Hmm.
It was called Track Record. They owned that, and then they sold it. At some point, they sold it. It's that black building.
So you played with Van for what, 2 years?
Off and on for 2.5 years.
And you did St. Dominic's Preview?
We did that.
You were an arranger on that record?
Yeah, I helped arrange. Jackie Wilson said, I will be there at St. Dominic's Preview. And I added things to the other one of the other songs, a song called Redwood Tree, because it wasn't really working. It was already ready to be recorded, so I just realized what it needed. It needed a little, like, it was a song that went along doing nothing, so to speak.
Right.
And there was a cool chorus, so I came up with a simple little guitar lick that put it into the chorus. And then later in the song, I did a little fast lick, and Van's very good at picking up on things that happen behind him and going with it. And you can hear both of those things on Redwood
Tree. That's amazing.
But St. Dominic's Preview was a disaster. And I had gotten into an argument with Van at one point when we were in the studio. We had already recorded Jackie Wilson Said and Gypsy, and then Van got mad at me because I told a new kid in the band how much he was going to pay us, and Van didn't want to pay him as much as he was paying the rest of us, and he fired me. And I went back to L.A., and Gary Malibur, the drummer, said, "Doug, don't go anywhere. He's going to need you because we have some more stuff to do." So I was down here. I don't remember what I was doing, and I got a call one night from Gary. He said, "Van's going to call you in a couple of minutes." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, the St. Dominic's Preview song we've got just sits there. It doesn't do anything." And he's had five L.A. guitar players come up here to try to do something with it, and he didn't like what they were doing. So he finally said, "I guess I'll take Doug again."
That's funny.
So I went up. They flew me up there. You could go up for $12. You go to Burbank Airport, no security, no identification, nothing. $12 cash to the stewardess to San Francisco.
That's crazy.
PSA, Poor Sailors Airline, Pacific Southwest Airlines. And they have the best looking stewardesses you ever saw.
Now, we're running out of time, but I want to actually get to your recording studio because you started a band and you had a lead singer die. Oddly enough, the name of the band was The Police. And then you started another band called The Pickles.
And another guy died.
One died of a heroin overdose. One guy died in a car accident.
Yes.
And you were just like, "I want to hang this up. I want to change my rehearsal space into a recording studio."
And now
you have one of the best and baddest recording studios. I've done my last three records there. I did Music of the New Day there. We recorded, mixed everything there. Yes. I did solo sessions at Giganter Studios, my drummer studio, and then we mixed it here. At Hard Drive. And then I did a record at Sun Studio.
And we mixed it.
And we did guitar overdubs.
Yeah.
But The Room is still one of my favorites in all of L.A. Let's just mention some of the people.
Good rooms.
Oh, yeah.
Mine.
Ocean Way, I've done. But it's still one of my favorites. And NK Band's going to come back in January and work with you on another record.
Thank you.
But let's just mention some of the people real quick and the records that you've made, because we've got about a minute left.
Okay.
You've done
Jimmy Eat World.
Beck, Loser was recorded there.
Part of it. That didn't really become a whole record while they were at my studio.
You did Plain White Tees.
Plain White Tees.
Hey There, Delilah.
Hey There, Delilah. We did that.
You did Mars Volta.
At the drive-in.
Yep.
We recorded on Newfound Glory.
Joe Bonamassa.
Jonah Bonamassa made a whole record with us.
I'm trying to think of who else. There's so many.
Robin Ford,
that's
Jimmy
right.
Jimmy Haslip and the guy, Jeff Babko,
and you've been working with
Hillary Jones.
Sade's producer.
And I'm working now with Sade's arranger and bass player, Paul Denman. And he's in a new band with Daniel Ash, who had Bauhaus. They were pretty big in L.A. back in the 80s.
And you have a piece of gear that's got a lot of history, rock and roll history. Yeah, you got a Stevens tape machine, the very tape machine that Pink Floyd recorded The Wall on.
Yeah, when it was
Steely Dan did Asia on.
Yeah,
Fleetwood Mac mixed Rumors on.
But that was when it was at Producer's Workshop. And I traded a guy who had bought the machine when that studio went under. And a few people had owned it. I think two people before me. And a guy had it, and he said, "It doesn't work. Trade me a machine that does work." So I gave him my 3M machine, which is a great machine, too.
And he gave you the Stevens.
But I knew that the Stevens is... It's
one of my favorite pieces of gear in your room.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And you know what? We just read a quote. You know, I read you a quote over the phone from Doug Sachs saying that your studio... Doug Sachs is no longer with us. He's a great mastering engineer. And he said your studio is one of the most impeccable studios in Los Angeles because of all the gear.
Well, that's sweet of him.
and he said, "You always listen." And you always do listen, Doug. And it's such a pleasure working with you. I'm very excited to have you on our show.
Well, thank you.
I'm going to have to wrap up, but this is going to be part one because I'm definitely bringing you back.
Are you a rapper?
I'm going to wrap up, but we're going to bring you back next time and have you talk about recording techniques and gear and some of the things you do with analog versus digital.
We do both, of course.
And share your genius with us, man, because
I wouldn't call it genius.
You are one of the baddest of the bad. And on behalf of Ronan, myself, and Eddie, we'll see you guys here next week.
God damn it! You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.